Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So another week here in the Bettinelli household, and we actually went into Boston to the Museum of Fine Arts for the first time in more than 2 years.
Yep.
So the last time we went was before the pandemic, and like everything else, everything shut down. And then even when it reopened, it was kind of, it would have been difficult for us. I think we mentioned before on the show how, you know, we go in, we get there, we look at an exhibit, and then it's time for lunch. And, you know, bringing a lunch is difficult. Let's just put it that way.
They don't let food into the museum, so you would have to leave the lunch in the car, go out to the car, or go back.
Yeah, go out to the garage or the parking lot, eat in the parking lot or the garage. Yeah, and nobody wants to do that. So you have to eat at the cafeteria, and the cafeteria was closed for the longest time. So now it's open, finally, and we went and we got our family membership. The funny thing was, and you didn't notice this, but when we were standing in line to get tickets to get our membership renewed, there was a family with five kids right in front of us. And then when we were in the cafeteria, there was another family with five kids sitting down at a nearby table. Like, what are the odds that you're going to have families with five kids like us just randomly at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston? It just, they had to have been tourists from out of town. I'm just saying. Because otherwise we probably would have known them, because we know all the big Catholic families,
no,
right?
No, we don't.
No, we don't. So it was, what was it like to, you know, what your impressions of going back for the first time in 2 years, just like in general, like we'll get to the exhibits, but just in general, the experience of being at the museum.
I mean, it was nice to be back. I love the museum. It's one of my favorite places. There were lots of people with masks, but that's kind of pretty typical.
Typical Boston now.
That's the world we live in, right?
Yeah. If someone doesn't feel comfortable, they'll throw a mask on. That's fine.
And, you know, but we've waited long enough that masks aren't mandatory in Boston anymore. So we didn't have to wear masks, and we chose not to.
Right.
Which.
That could turn out to be a bad idea.
We will see in a few days. If anybody gets sick, then we will know that that was not the smartest idea. But
yeah. So, yeah, I agree. And the museum was fairly crowded.
Yeah, especially the special exhibit, which it was the last week of the special exhibit. So
it ended today. In fact, there was an exhibit of the British artist J.M. Turner, who's famous for his landscapes.
J.W. Turner?
J.M.W. Turner, I think it was.
Ah.
Turner.
Anyway.
Yeah. If you Google British artist Turner, that's who will come up. So, I mean, now I'm going to go look it up. Yeah, so I didn't know a lot about Turner except that he was a landscape artist from the, you know, early 19th century. So
I could identify a Turner, like go, oh, that's probably Turner. It's got water and it's got really brilliant skies with lots of gorgeous light.
Right.
In fact, I think on the National Gallery's Artle game. We were talking about games last week.
Uh-huh.
Turner was one of the artists 1 week, and I totally got it in two paintings.
Ah.
So and the first one was a very non-typical Turner painting with, like, pick people in it, and I didn't get it because of that.
Yeah. Well, so the Turner, they had more than 100 paintings from Turner in this exhibit. It was huge. It was big. It was maybe a little overwhelming for a couple of kids, but
there was, we tried to look at every painting until the last two galleries. And then we were like, we're like going to look at the big ones, and we're not going to look at all the prints, the watercolors and the sketches and the smaller pieces.
There were some truly awe-inspiring paintings. There's the Battle of Trafalgar painting where that shows the death of Lord Nelson. Huge, like a massive, what, like 12 feet diagonal? I mean, 10 feet? It was massive. On the wall next to Hannibal and his army crossing the Alps in a snowstorm. Just massive paintings. But then you had smaller paintings. You had even small, lots and lots of sketches.
Yeah, I really, one of the things I really liked about this exhibit was they included several of his sketchbooks and some of his
incomplete works.
Incomplete works, his early works, like some paintings what he did when he was a teenager. And so it really gave much more of a breadth of, I always love seeing the sort of in process pieces too.
Yeah.
Like, how does he go about it? Like the sketch and then the finished painting, like together, that sort of thing. Or, and the sketchbooks are just like, I love sketchbooks. They're
just
so cool.
Yeah. Just the broad, literally the broad strokes of a subject, just like the little bit of here and there. Sometimes very detailed sketches, like his ship sketches that he did for the Battle of Trafalgar. He went aboard Nelson's ship, the Victory, and very detailed drawings of everything on the deck. But apparently he was a commercial artist. Like he made his living by painting for patrons. Someone would hire him. And sometimes he would do things on spec. So he would begin painting a subject, and it would just be very broad strokes. And then he would try to get a patron to pay him to complete the work. But if no one wanted the work, he would just abandon it. He would just throw it to the side.
Right. And there were several bits of where he had tried to get some royal patronage and failed, which was interesting too.
Yeah. Apparently when he died, he bequeathed 300 paintings and like 30,000 paper, like paint drawings on paper, and all his sketchbooks and all this sort of stuff to the British people, basically, and it's now in the Tate, the which is the big museum in Britain. The one that a lot of people know is the slave ship. Slavers throwing overboard the dead and the dying as a typhoon comes on. That's actually part of the MFA's own collection.
That one was mobbed like the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. The crowd in front of it was crazy.
They had a lot of interpretive stuff around it, too. They had people like from the time it was painted in the 1850s all the way to today. People, you know, like on the wall, like quotes from people there. Response to it.
There was also a video where they had different people talking about the painting, and you could stand there and watch the video.
Mm-hmm.
Was on a loop. Actually, there were a couple different videos, because there was also a video earlier on in the exhibit where they had a watercolor artist recreate one of the watercolors. So they had the painting mm-hmm. on the wall, and then a video screen of this woman painting it.
Right.
Painting a copy of it, which was kind of interesting because you talked a lot about the technique and the colors and that sort of thing. I didn't get to watch the whole video. There was a huge crowd, but I watched part of it and the kids were fascinated by that.
So Bella really was into drawing. So he did a lot of seascapes, and Bella was into sketching a lot of sails. She was really into the sails, but because he was painting as the Industrial Revolution was getting going in Britain, he painted a lot of stuff that featured the intersection of industry and nature, like canals or industrial works in the country.
Right. You get factories, canals, bridges, piers, steamships, lots and lots of steamships. Some really cool night scenes of people
working
on ships, like unloading the coal at night off right. of the
Newcastle. Yeah. Right.
It was a really cool image because they were unloading the coal off of sailing ships onto barges
to be
used for like railways and right. steam engines and things. But that kind of, he really exists at that time period between
the transition,
the age of sail and the age of steam, like where there's both.
Right.
And there were several interesting pieces, like one with the shipwreck that had both sailing, you know, several with sailing ships and steamships in the same mm-hmm. frame.
So some of my favorites was like the one I mentioned before, the Battle of Trafalgar. I just love that one. There was one of the Battle of Waterloo, which is at night, and it's all very dark, except for in the foreground is this light area where you see, you know, the soldiers and horses and stuff, and then above
actually, what you're seeing is the women searching the battlefield after the battle,
right,
for the slain, to find those who are still alive or to identify the dead,
right. And then illuminating the whole field is a rocket, like it had been shot up into the air, and it's illuminating the field, and that's where the light is coming from. There's a beautiful painting of Venice, the Dogana and San Giorgio Maggiore. Beautiful, very detailed. So he had different styles. Some were very like almost impressionist. Some were very detailed. So just a really interesting breadth of it. If you ever get a chance to see his work or just even look it up online, there's some really fantastic pieces there. And you can watch the videos on the MFA website, by the way. There's the video of the painting at Turner Watercolor, the perspectives on Turner's slave ship.
We should go back and watch those since we missed them.
Yeah, yeah. Those are on the website if you go to MFA.org. So after that, we went and got our lunch. And then after lunch, we wanted to see, because so much has changed, they've changed a few things in the last few years. We wanted to see the ancient world exhibits. There was a... what was it? The Egyptians where we went first?
Yeah, they redone the Egyptian gallery and the Greek and Roman galleries.
Right, that's what it was. Kind of swapped some of them.
Yeah, they'd moved some of the stuff that was downstairs upstairs, and some of the stuff that was upstairs downstairs, and they'd reinterpreted a lot of the Egyptian works. Interestingly, a lot of the Egyptian gallery, the new gallery, the new
statuary gallery especially, right. Yeah.
Focuses on the connection between Boston and Egypt, and why does Boston have this collection? And there was a dig that was sponsored by the MFA and Harvard University.
Right.
The Egyptian government basically I think it was 1905.
Right. It contracted out to...
They realized that raiders, tomb robbers
yeah.
were hauling away a lot of their archaeological finds, but the Egyptian government at the time didn't have money to excavate everything. So they contracted out, they cut a deal with
the Americans, the Germans, Italians, and the Germans.
Italians. And so they kind of divided up the area of Giza, and they contracted basically for a portion of the dig.
Right. So a part of the great Eastern, I think it is, cemetery. And then they divided up the different pyramids. And of course, I think the Germans went for the Germans and the Italians both competed for the big Khufu pyramid. But the Americans were very smart because they realized the tomb robbers already probably emptied that of everything of interest. So they went for the smaller. They said, we'll take the smaller pyramids. We'll let you have the big one.
We'll take the third one. And it was a wise choice because that one actually did have more in it.
I like the fact that they put all the statuary together so that you could see, you could compare and understand. And they had some really interesting newer interpretations of them. So that newer scholarship has been informing the materials that they talk about. It's like they used to think that these were found together and they thought there was a married couple, but it turns out they're probably not. And this is why we say that blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, there isn't enough evidence to say that was a conjecture that without evidence. And it's really interesting.
It was definitely an exhibit that I would like to go back and spend more time on.
Yeah.
And read more of the interpretive materials. Like sometimes the interpretive materials can feel like they're imposing on you, but sometimes they really tell an interesting story.
Especially when they tell the story of the excavation and the people.
Yeah, I really liked the fact that they were really talking about, especially in this day and age when we've become a lot more aware of growing understanding that maybe these things should not have been removed from their countries of origin.
Right.
And so kind of interpreting it in terms of this was sort of the best that they could do at the time.
Right. Although I'm of two minds of this whole, like you shouldn't remove things, because there's also the value of everyone knows Egypt. Everyone loves Egypt. Everyone understands the necessity to like everyone around the world, the necessity to preserve Egyptian culture. Like, I get that there's competing goods here. Like,
there are competing goods.
Yeah, and the way a lot of this is done was bad. I grant that. But there is also there has been a good that has come of it, which is that the Egyptian culture has this pride of interest, this pride of place in the popular imagination that many other cultures don't have. And that's partly because these things have been brought. And so we can go in Boston and go down and look at these things up close and see them, and where you can't do that with a lot of other cultures. But I get, you know, like the things were stolen, like the Benin, what are they called? There's African artifacts that were stolen by British colonizers, and they're all in the process of being returned to the country. Right. I get there's that tension.
Of course, things could be returned and then still loaned out. Like traveling exhibits are one way that museums earn money, and also they trade traveling exhibits so that they can.
And it pays for the preservation of the goods,
right?
Because, you know, do these countries, do they have the resources to preserve these their heritage? Maybe this is a way to help them to pay for that. So I grant that. That's true. So we saw the Egyptian statue. The Greek exhibit with the vases and the Greek pottery was really cool. And in fact, I don't know if you saw it, but they had a cartoon.
I didn't get to watch the video. The kids were watching that while I was looking around. It was
a pretty well done cartoon to teaching the kids about how pottery is made.
The multimedia stuff that the Museum of Fine Arts does is always really good quality. Mm-hmm. They have a huge coin collection at the MFA.
Ancient coins, yeah.
And they actually had something about like the origin of the coin collection was these two sisters who were huge coin collectors. And they bequeathed their collection to the museum, but also funding to
future acquisitions.
Continue adding to the collection, but only the best of the best coins.
Right.
And they have just rows upon rows of coins with, you know, magnifying glasses so you can really get a good look at them. Mm-hmm. And amazing, really, really cool. Coins from the ancient world.
One of the things that the exhibit mentioned was, like, coins could be any shape and have been in history. They're squares and triangles and, you know, rectangles. But the round coin that we're familiar with, our pennies and dimes and quarters and stuff, the Greeks came up with that. And, like, I think about that, like, huh, I never really thought, like, why are our coins this shape and general size? Well, because the Greeks made it that way. You know, it's kind of funny to think about, like to have that presented to you in that way. Speaking of multimedia, one of the things they had was an interactive exhibit where kids or adults, I suppose, could create their own Greek or Roman coin using various, you know, standard images.
Like it's more of a kid.
It's more of a kid thing. No, it is a kid thing. And of course, like the one, what do the boys pick? They pick the one of like Venus with her butt hanging out of her toga. It's the top of the coin. And they thought that was the funniest thing ever.
And some curator put that image in the database precisely for that reason.
Yes, because the little boys will be laughing there hysterically at it. And why not? It'll be funny and get them interested in looking at the coins and stuff. There was a coin with an octopus that was totally a Hail Hydra.
Oh, yeah. They totally got the Hydra image from something like that.
Yeah. They had an exhibit with like everyday life in Greece, like in the Greek culture, some really interesting stuff there. And so it was really nice. I mean, we spent how many hours there? Maybe 4 hours there?
Probably about 4 hours.
And saw 10% of the museum again. Like, that's one of the great things about the MFA and why I have no problem buying a family membership. Because we're going to go back over the course of the year again and again, because there's always more to see. And we've been members for years. But it's always good to go back and see it.
I would love to be able to go and just sit and draw. I'm always a little bit jealous of Bella being able to do that because I end up spending time with the children who are least amenable to being there, helping them to enjoy the experience by interpreting the work with them, like looking at things with them and talking about it, which is fun, but it is work. And I would kind of like to be able to go through my own pace and sit and draw and like relax a little bit. I'm thinking maybe someday we'll take just a sketching trip to the museum of just me and the older girls.
That would be nice. That's a great idea. I know I was going through with Anthony. We would stop at a picture and I would point and go, okay, tell me what you see. How many of the of those things are there? Why do you think that, you know, person is there doing that gesture? Why do you think the artist really made that person really detailed, but the ones around them less detailed? And why do you think the light is like that? So just trying to help them to understand how to look at a painting and what am I looking at? What am I seeing? I mean, there's the level of looking at a painting where it's like, oh, I see a scene. Okay. And that's what the scene is. But there's also digging deeper. And especially when you're in person with a painting, and I love seeing like, when like an oil painting with a, where the artist like slathered on the paint, like there's a painting of the Houses of Parliament on fire. And you could see where Turner just like took a palette, like it just a stick with paint on it, and just smeared it across the painting to visualize the fires into the, going into the sky. And it was just it's just awesome. I mean,
that or where they deliberately leave the canvas, like where you can see the canvas through the paint because it's so thin.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
those are the details you can't see when you even a really, I suppose, the really, really good photographic,
really high resolution. Yeah.
You can sometimes see those details.
But this is why I love to go to an exhibit and stand in front of the painting and see.
You know, when I was a kid, we did not have a world-class museum in Austin. And so going to museums was something that we did very rarely and only when we were on trips. And I didn't feel like I knew how to look at art. And I didn't really, my parents tried to take us, but I didn't really have a good idea of what I was looking for and how to look. And I feel like even now I'm still learning somewhat to like look at portraits of people. Like, what am I looking for? What am I trying to see? And it's interesting to really take the time to not try to see everything, but just to try to really see something.
So, friend of SQPN and friend online, Billy Newton is he's an art expert and he writes art. Articles for on art for like the Federalist and other publications, and I always enjoy reading his stuff and looking at his Instagram when he goes and visits art exhibitions, because he does that. He like it really opens up the world of art for you if you can have someone help you see. I mean, that's really what it's about, is to see what am I seeing. I'm so glad we do this for the kids, because we didn't do this when I was a kid. And so so one of the things that on the way in, we were driving in, a lot of our tastes obviously have rubbed off on our kids, and including taste in architecture. And I must have commented on brutalist architecture before.
When my mom was here, they were playing some sort of a identify art game.
Okay.
And they learned they learned the term brutalism, but they didn't really understand it in terms of an art movement. So
I've commented how the Boston City Hall is brutalist architecture. I've commented on that for several times.
Anyway, so they absorbed the idea that brutalist means ugly. And so while we were driving in, Anthony pointed to a building and said, oh, that's brutalist.
He kept pointing to all kinds of buildings saying, that's brutalist. Oh, that's brutalist.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, brutalism doesn't just mean an ugly building. Like, it was a specific art movement. And anyway, it was kind of lost on him, but
I
tried. So then I made a joke, which
kids... you tried to get. So this, let me get it out. So that, cause you tried to get it out and you didn't.
No, you got it wrong.
Okay. Go ahead.
It's only brutalism if it comes from the brutal region of France. Anything else is just sparkling ugliness.
Okay. I think it works better as sparkling ugly architecture, but okay.
No, sparkling ugliness works better.
Okay.
See, this is the thing. You changed it to what you think sounds better, but that's not what I actually said.
That's not what you actually said either, because you started laughing so hard, you couldn't actually even say it. So I had to say the rest of it, because they're all like, why is mom laughing hysterically?
Yeah. See, this is the thing. I'm not very good at delivering jokes, because if it's really funny, then I'm laughing too hard to actually say it. Anyway.
So... Museum of Fine Arts, if you're ever in Boston, definitely go. It's top of my list of recommendations of things to visit.
I feel like my soul is now awake again. Like some part of my soul has been asleep for 2 years because I haven't been able to go.
Yeah. I mean, you don't just encounter God in church. You encounter truth and beauty in the world around us, including, and I'd say perhaps especially in art. I mean, there's a reason why so much art is religious art. And because I think art is one of the, outside of praying and, you know, partaking of the sacraments, one of the primary ways in which we encounter God.
Speaking of religious art, there are some really, really cool Jewish artifacts at the museum.
Oh, yeah.
There was one piece that really struck me. I took a picture of it, of a Jewish man reading, and it's a very, very small picture, like narrower than
like a playing card, smaller than a playing card.
Yeah, the width was about the width of a playing card or an index card. The height was about twice that. And it was just this very small, narrow, but the frame was
huge.
Huge. Like each side of the frame was bigger than the actual painting in. So it was almost like you were looking into this very small window.
It was a window into a world.
Yeah. And he had been, there's a candle next to him that's been sniffed out and like very thin gray light, like he's been reading, studying all night long. And according to the interpretive placard, at the very top of the frame where you couldn't really see it under the shadows, it had some words from the prayer, the Shema, which is the
Shema Israel, Hero Israel.
Hero Israel, the Lord is our God. I'm trying to remember which of the words it was. Anyway, so obviously he's been studying Torah all night.
Right.
Which was beautiful. But one of my favorite pieces.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just want to get to this. Was these pieces from Germany of Torah binders. And they're the wraps that hold the scrolls of the Torah shut. But these were really cool. They were made from the swaddling clothes that were used when the baby was circumcised. When the boy was circumcised.
Yeah.
And then the mother would take them and sew them into these long strips and then embroider them with this prayer for him to have a holy life with Torah reading and a good marriage.
Right.
And his name and the date. And then they would present it when his first time he visited the synagogue when he was like 3 or 4. And then it would be used at his bar mitzvah when he read Torah in the synagogue for the first time. Yep. And I was like, such a beautiful artifact. There were these gorgeous hand embroidered, big, long banners of cloth. And the story really, again, where the interpretation really grabbed me. I was like, it caught my eye from across the gallery. And I thought, that looks really interesting. It looks Hebrew. What is it? But then the story of what it was really captured my imagination.
What caught my imagination was the fact that it was from Germany. And just imagining like the people for whom, the family. Escaped. Yeah. Did they escape? You know, that's the thing. I just, because my grandfather was Jewish, that sort of stuff really connects with me.
And that these are, works of art, but they're very, like, they're female works of art. It's a mom sewing into a garment her prayers for her son.
Right.
Which really hit me as a mom, like the way that the embroidery became a prayer for his whole life.
Yep.
With images of, imagine the mom of the baby sewing the image of the married couple under the wedding canopy and looking forward to someday her son's going to get married. And it's just so really cool.
Speaking of your son growing up, that was the other bit of stuff that happened this week. Ben had his 13th birthday. He is now a teenager. And so
now we've got three teenagers.
Now we have three teenagers in the house. And fairly low-key birthday. Some families have birthdays are huge affairs. For us, they're fairly low-key. As we've talked about before, get up in the morning, he opens his presents, we go to dinner, and then there's cake after we get back from dinner. We usually go out for dinner. Ben's choice for dinner was Pizzeria Regina. It is
inarguably the best pizza in Boston, so he has good taste. Yeah.
The best chain, anyway. I haven't tried it, but there are some people who send Tarpeo's and some of the other single location pizza places. But for my money, Pizzeria Regina is the best. Papa Gino's the second for chain pizza in Boston area. And so he, I was not going to dispute that. It was the least expensive option that we've had for a birthday dinner in a while. So the, but the only Pizzeria Regina locally is at the food court at the mall, the big mall nearby. So we went to the food court and got the pizzas there. And Lucy doesn't really like pizza, although she tried it and liked it. She liked the Pizzeria Regina. And so we got some sushi at the food court sushi place for her. And I got some for the rest of us because we all like sushi. And then afterward, we went to the Lego store, as you do. And
as one does.
And Ben picked out some Lego sets. In addition, he got a Boba Fett Slave One Lego set that we gave him. But he picked out a couple others that he wanted to buy with his own money. So it was nice. And it was, again, a good chance for the kids to get out. Interesting. Again, have not been in the mall very much over the past couple of years. And one of the things that struck me was the number of stores that were, they weren't shut down. They weren't out of business. They were just closed on a Saturday afternoon. And mainly, I think, based on what I saw on signs in the doors, because they couldn't get staff to for all the shifts.
Right.
Like they're just understaffed. It boggles. I don't think I've ever seen that before. It boggled my mind. That was Ben's birthday, and we had cake. You made him a cake, a chocolate cake.
I made a very super moist sour cream chocolate cake with a cream cheese frosting.
So
super
good. You know why he said he wanted a Konditormeister cake? Which Konditormeister is the German bakery that's nearby that makes it really good. Because a few years ago, we got him a Konditormeister cake.
It was 2020. It was the height of the pandemic. And he was refusing to leave the house because he wouldn't wear a mask.
Right.
And I told him I would buy him a Konditormeister cake if he put on a mask and went into the store with me to pick out the cake. This was part of his therapy, like in terms of trying to acclimate him to just, I'm like, you could wear it long enough to go into the store and then come out and then take it off. And I was totally willing to buy him a super expensive birthday cake.
Yes.
If it is part of his.
Konditormeister cakes are expensive and worth it. Like they were so good. We used to get one for you for your birthday because I don't make you bake your own cake.
Although last year I did bake my own cake because I wanted carrot cake.
Right. So that was Ben's birthday. And then I was able to visit my mom. So my mom's in a nursing home now. She's in a Carmelite nursing home. They're Carmelites. I was telling the sister there that your dad's a Carmelite.
Yeah, although he's a discalced Carmelite, and I would bet that they are OCARMs.
Probably.
The discalced don't do things like run hospitals and schools. And
right. Things. So, yeah, they and if they get in the same room, they fight and stuff. And it's really bad. So anyway, when I got there, it turns out that my brother Bernie and his wife Carol were there with my dad. So it was nice catching up, and we sat out on the patio with them. But it was good to see my mom is declining, just to put it straightforward. And she can't really live at home anymore, and she needs round the clock care. So if you get inspired, say a prayer for my mom and in that her situation, it's not going to get better. Let's put it that way. So that's what we've been doing. So let's talk about food because we've been talking here for a half hour. Let's talk about some of the food we made this week. So one of the dishes I made was something I'd seen, I think it was in Milk Street Kitchen, which was a recipe for Vietnamese style caramel shrimp. And this was very interesting to me. And it's the recipe they have is very basic. It's basically just shrimp and maybe scallions and a sauce. But what it is, you basically make a caramel. So you put sugar and water in the skillet and cook it until it browns. And then you add fish sauce, which you boil up. Then you add some hot pepper, chili peppers, shallots, garlic, ginger. If you have lemongrass, you could add that. And then at the end, you add in shrimp and cook it till it's done and serve it over rice. And I ended up adding mushrooms and bell pepper. Did I add carrot too?
No,
I didn't add carrot.
I could have added carrots.
And I cooked it because of the way it worked. I cooked those just separately in a wok and then added it in at the end with the sauce. It was okay.
Yeah.
It didn't have a really strong flavor. I thought it would have a more like that caramelly. I don't know. I was looking for something more. It was okay. It was fine. So the other things I made today, I made two things on the smoker. I'd picked up some London broil from the supermarket. It was on sale, big sale a few months ago, and I'd thrown it in the freezer. And so I've got a couple of them in there, and I pulled one out, and it turns out London broil is not a cut of beef. It's a preparation, and you can have flank steak London broil, or you could have top round London broil. And so this was a top round. And what makes a London broil is that you marinate it and then kind of cook it like a roast beef. Okay. And then you slice it up thin. And so what I did was I made a marinade, and I kind of went off of a bunch of different recipes. But basically what I did was I'm going to pull up the so olive oil. I did like a half a cup of olive oil, a quarter cup of red wine vinegar, a couple tablespoons of honey. I did a couple tablespoons of Worcestershire and a couple tablespoons of soy sauce. Then I added some, pepper, salt, pepper, a little bit of minced dried garlic, like garlic powder, and I'm trying to think of anything else I put into the marinade. I think that was it from the marinade. And then I put a steak rub that I just bought from How to Barbecue Right. Is the website howtobbqright.com. Their steak rub. I put that on there, and then I marinated it for probably 6 hours, maybe 8 hours while I was gone. And then threw it in the smoker, and it was supposed to smoke for 2 hours, but the smoker was too hot and it was done within an hour. And so I pulled it off. I kind of wish it had been able to do it for 2 hours. I think it might have come out even better. Mm-hmm. The kids were raving about it. They loved it. What did you think of the London broil?
It was good.
It was okay.
The flavor was good.
Yeah. The smoke was not great. I don't know.
Yeah.
I felt like the smoke might have been a little too accurate. I think at certain times, I was really having trouble. I'm still trying to figure out how to get the smoker to maintain a steady heat. I'm still working on the fire. I might just like start running a fire in there and just like run a test fire without cooking anything in there. And just try to get down the whole method of keeping the heat steady. So then the other thing I made was smoked bacon wrapped jalapeno poppers. I'd seen some videos for these on different websites, different YouTube channels. And what I did was you take a big jalapenos and you slice them in half and you scrape out all the seeds and the membranes, so all the spicy stuff. Then you take some cream cheese. I had some Mexican cheese, like a Mexican cheese blend, and I also added in a tablespoon of some leftover buffalo sauce from the wings I made a couple weeks ago, and mix that up real good. Then I kind of spoon that into the halves, the jalapeno halves, and then wrap a slice of bacon around it. And then I put a barbecue rub, a shake of some barbecue rub over the top of it, and then smoke that for about an hour. Now, I thought it was good, and you had some ideas for the next time.
I thought it would be better with a little bit of American cheese and maybe a little bit less of the Mexican cheese. Mm-hmm. I think I wanted something that was a little bit more creamy, and the poppers I've had in restaurants, I'm pretty sure have had like American or Velveeta cheese in them in addition to the sour cream cheese.
Well, sour cream might be another thing way to do too. Like like half cream cheese, but half sour cream.
I felt like the cheese was just a little heavy and a little sharp and not quite creamy. And the mouthfeel felt a little bit wrong.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad. It just needed a little tweaking.
Right. And, I probably could put more, the buffalo sauce was my idea. I didn't see it in any recipes, but I could have probably put more buffalo sauce in it.
Although that sort of depends on the heat of the jalapenos. Like, these jalapenos were fairly mild, but if it was
any too spicier,
hot a pepper, then that might have been overkill.
But they were big, so bigger peppers, I think, tend to be less spicy, the bigger jalapenos. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do it, just get bigger. Make sure you get bigger ones. What was the other thing? Oh, the bacon wasn't as crispy as I wanted it to be. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this again, but I'm going to do it in the oven and see if I can get that part of it. Just get the ingredients right and then try the smoker again after that. But you know, I want to get the straight up popper better. Overall, the kids liked it. I mean, Isabella loved the London broil. She thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. So that was good. I want to do more smoking, though. I want to use the smoker part of the grill more often than I have been.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's talk about things we've been watching. We're still both working on books. You're still working on that Vers Kosian saga. And I'm working on a new Tom Clancy novel. But I'll talk about those when I'll talk about my novel probably next week. I think I'll be done with it by then. But I watched the finale, the season 3 finale from Stranger Things, the latest season. They had the last two episodes were delayed, a few weeks after the first part of the season. The last episode was over 2 hours. It was like 2.5 hours long. I don't know that it needed to be 2.5 hours long. It was good. I liked it. There were very Christological themes in it. Character who's very clearly images of crucifixion, images of a savior against fighting against what looks like the devil, that sort of thing. We learn a lot more about the upside down and the world, and so it's some good stuff. Some hard sacrifices that happen, which we're interesting to see. Some good family stuff. I'm trying not to spoil anything. There's one scene which is kind of funny, where one of the characters has to fight one of the Demogorgons, the big creatures from the upside down with the face that opens up like a flower petal and it's with teeth. And he has to fight it with a sword. And I noticed the sword is the Conan sword from Conan the Barbarian. Because this is set in the 80s, that's such an 80s thing. I love that is such like an iconic sword of the 80s. So it was really kind of fun to see that. Like, I don't know why it was there. It just had to be thrown in there by the directors as a homage to the 80s.
The props guy was just like, hey, we got this sword lying around. Let's use it.
No, I think it was intentional. I think it was like,
that was a joke.
Okay. The quintessential 80s sword. So that was really kind of cool. And then they left the door open to season 4. There's very clearly a season 4 coming with, which should be the final season, I would think. We watched the episode 2 of the Loki season with the kids today. And yeah. I have to say, I really like how this Loki has changed and the personality difference in this Loki versus the smarmy, annoying Loki of the early Avengers movies.
Well, I mean, in a way, this is kind of Loki without Thor, without Asgard, without anything to push, he's not nothing to push against, but it's kind of him stripped of a lot of the stuff that.
Right. He's sort of just got to rely on the people around him and his own wits.
The scene in the first episode where he is like stripped of everything and then he's told that his magic doesn't work here. Like, he really is reduced down to
the basics.
Yeah.
Nothing. Yeah.
And they kind of pulse his character down to the basics. Like, who is Loki when he's not fighting Thor, when he's not striving for the throne of Asgard or trying to conquer Midgard, or, when he doesn't have his magic and he's relying just on his wits and he's in out of his depth.
Right.
So on the character level, I think that the show is really interesting. I'm still on the plot level, I'm still not really sold on the whole plausibility of the TVA, I guess.
Yeah, well, the whole plausibility of, but as the series goes on, they kind of cast doubt on the plausibility of the TVA too. Like the whole mission of the TVA, I think it's undermined by the revelations that we get. Everything about the TVA is sort of a gaslight.
It feels like a shell game.
It's right. They're somebody is gaslighting everyone. There's less there. There's, you know, don't pull the curtain back to see the man behind the curtain. You know, it's a little bit Wizard of Oz.
But why? I feel like that the show.
Well, that's the thing is we don't get is
leaves unanswered the why.
We see the who, but we don't understand the why. And that's a big part of it. There is a line in this one that really, I think, kind of outlines what this series is about, where Loki says, you know, you're making the mistake that everyone makes, that bad guys are not, what does it say? Bad guys are not truly through and through bad, and good guys are not completely good. Like, bad guys are not completely bad, and good guys are not completely good. And there's a truth that's true. Everyone is redeemable. No one is lost. Everyone can be saved from evil. But also, the good guys are sinners. We're not perfect. We have our flaws and our faults, and we sin. That it's a very Catholic, Christological, Christian point of view on humanity.
I really do like this scene in the first episode when Owen Wilson's character sort of confronts Loki, like, what is your purpose? What are you trying to achieve? Aren't you the villain? Are you happy being the villain? Like, there's a
right.
He pushes him into like a sort of self-reflection that Loki is clearly uncomfortable with, that degree of reflection. Right. He doesn't want to think, he just wants to act.
Right. He shows him this image of him killing a guy in the Avengers movie, and he's like, you look, you're grinning there. And he's like, no, it's not really. And you can see he's uncomfortable admitting
that
he's the bad guy.
Right. And then Owen Wilson in the second episode, though, he adopts Loki's phrase, you know, talking about the glorious purpose of the TVA. And so then you sort of throws into question what is glorious purpose?
Right. That there's a lot. In fact, that was the title of the first episode, was Glorious Purpose. And that was Loki's line about he had a glorious purpose. That was why he would try to conquer Earth and all this other stuff. But what is that glorious purpose? Where does it come from? It in and of itself is not the end that either one is going for. So it's really interesting. So then we also watched the latest episode of Ms. Marvel, which continues to be a really good show. We yes. really enjoy it. Really good historical look at partition in Pakistan and India. The little bit of time travel going on.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, that was good.
And continuing really excellent relationship building between Kamala and her mom and her grandmother. The three generations of women unpacking their pasts and talking about, like, their relationships.
Right.
Really, really good. I mean, just the mother-daughter relationships there are so well done.
I think one of the key important points in a parent-child relationship is that the point at which the child is old enough to relate to the parent as an understanding that the parent was once like them, and the revelations of the parent's past. You know, like Kamala sees pictures of her mom as the wild rebel kid who snuck off to go to a Bon Jovi concert, you know?
Right.
Like, you, mom? Like, that revelation, and that happened with my parents, too. That moment when you, like, my parents were regular folks like me, and I can relate to them on that level. They were teenagers once. They were young adults once.
And her mom still has a rocky relationship with her own mom. Like, yes. She it's kind of clear that she left Pakistan in order to get away from her family.
Right.
Like, not like cutting ties completely, but she wanted some distance between herself and her mom. Like, she couldn't quite deal with everything. And she sort of ran away.
Because her mom was kind of, well, she thought her mom was kind of crazy. Turns out her mom's not crazy. She's actually,
well, she's actually caught up in these stuff that, like,
the supernatural superhero nonsense, right. Sorry, not nonsense, but stuff. Yeah.
There was a great line in one of the earlier episodes where they're talking about the understanding of the supernatural beings from the other dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And they refer to themselves as djinn.
Yes.
Which fits into, you know,
genies.
Genies, yeah. Pakistani mythology. And she said, you know, well, you know, if Thor had come to Pakistan or India, he would have been considered a djinn.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting way of kind of reframing the whole mythology of the MCU. Like, a lot of how these beings from other dimensions or other worlds are perceived has to do with the frame of reference of the human beings who encounter them. The people right. from our world who encounter them.
The Eternals movie does that. That's the entirety almost of that movie. So that's what I think this phase of the MCU is doing, is it's really exploring how these superheroes fit into the mythos, just like Moon Knight was the same way.
It's true.
Yeah. So after Ms. Marvel, you also watched Grace season one. I've been talking about watching Grace season two. Yeah,
you've been talking about it so much that I thought I'd, and my mom actually mentioned that she liked it too. So I went and watched it.
Which is only two episodes in season one.
Right. It was good. I really liked the characters. The second show
episode
especially was really intense.
Yes.
And I would say watch it with caution. If you're easily upset by strong visuals and violence, maybe not for you. If you're claustrophobic or the idea of dealing with burial alive,
yeah, bothers you, someone's,
don't watch.
Yeah, this. Someone gets buried alive. So
someone gets buried alive. It was really,
and then there's the clock ticking to save them.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was a little bit much, and there was a lot of the like really scary. Somebody's out there who can kind of find you on the technological internet, that sort of thing really kind of tends to creep me out.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Somebody's watching you and you don't know where they are and how much they know, and they could be anywhere. They could be right there. That. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of that in that episode. Yeah. But I really like John Sims' character, Grace. And I don't know, there's something about the character that's very compelling to me. The pathos, that he's lost his wife, that the other cops don't really trust him. They think he's a bit of a nut job.
He seems to have almost an addiction for going to see the psychic guy. Like, he can't stop himself. He has,
even after he's been ordered, he just knows that this guy has answers for him.
And he actually does have answers, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
But there's almost something like it really struck me as being like an addict. Like, he just can't stay away.
Right. Which is related to his wife having gone missing, and he was using psychics to help find her. And he, you know, he's convinced that she's still out there because the psychic tells him so. Whereas everyone else thinks that she's dead. I mean, it's just as, well, if she was alive, they'd know by now. It's been years. So, yeah, it's a really good series. It's two episodes in the first season, three episodes in the second season. So you can watch it really quick. It's on BritBox, which you can get on Amazon Prime, or you can get separately if you're interested. So that's what we've been watching. Let's talk about this week's mass readings. So this was the Gospel of the Good Samaritan was the gospel reading. The first reading is very interesting because it's from Deuteronomy, and Moses says to the people, talking about God, the word of God, the voice of the Lord, the book of the law. It is not too mysterious and remote for you, he tells them. It's not up in the sky that you should say, who will go up in the sky to get it for us and tell us of it that we may carry it out? Nor is it across the sea that you should say, who will cross the sea to get it for us and tell us of it that we may carry it out? No, it's something very near to you, already in your mouths and in your hearts. You have only to carry it out. And I really like this because what he's basically saying is the word of God is not something foreign and exotic.
Right.
You know, it's not something that is imposed on us from outside, like a lot of the other pagan religions of the time. You know, there some priest devises the words of the gods and hands it out to the people, and like, oh, I guess we're going to take it. I guess we accept that. Whereas the word of God, not only is it written down in the book of the law, but it lives in our heart, in the natural law. Like, right. We know what is true because it's already here. Now, what he's saying is, you have no excuses for living this, for living out this law that we've been handed to you. It's already in you. So I really like that reading. It's really good for that. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that one.
Right. I think Father kind of connected it to the idea of conscience, that we have this,
right.
This spirit dwelling in us, but also sort of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right. Right. It's intimately connected with conscience. To know what is right and wrong is written in our heart. So then there's the second reading, which is about Jesus is the image of the invisible God, which is, you know, the firstborn of all creation, and just kind of setting Jesus above everything. He is thrones and dominions and principalities and powers, all were created through him and for him. And where Paul is just really setting Jesus up as, this is who Jesus is. He's not just another prophet. He's not just a teacher. He is the second person of the Holy Trinity. I mean, he doesn't say that, but that's what he is essentially saying there. And that takes us then to the gospel, the Good Samaritan. I like this. You have the smarmy scholar of the law who stands up, you know, like, I'm going to be teacher's pet. Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Knowing that Jesus is going to say, well, what's the law say? Oh, well.
Well, yeah, the clue there is he stood up to test Jesus.
Yes.
So it's not a genuine question. It's a disingenuous question that's meant to be a test, not right. Because he's truly seeing Jesus as a teacher from whom he can learn.
Right. So he says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, that is correct. But the guy doesn't want to let it go. So to test Jesus further, or it says to justify himself, he said to Jesus, who is my neighbor?
Justify, that was a word that jumped out at me, because I really wanted to know what the original was, because
yeah.
You know, theologically speaking, we can't justify ourselves. Only God can justify us. So is he talking about, is it hinting at the idea of, like, he's implying that he can save himself, he can make himself righteous? Or is it just he's excusing, or it feels like there's something going on there, and I can't quite.
There's a specific technical meaning of that. I'm trying to pull up verbum so I can look at the Greek that's the word that is there. Because I'm just distracted here. 25, 27. Lawyer. I'm looking at the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible on it, and it doesn't have the connection to it. I should have looked it up beforehand. There's a specific technical meaning for justify there. But the important part is like, he's still testing Jesus. Who is my neighbor? Basically what's going on is, you know, you could fulfill the law by following everything in the commandment, but you can't do it if you ignore the last line. It's easy to do the first part in one sense, as the Pharisees and the Sadducees, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your strength, and all your mind. Like, it's easy to look like you're living all that.
But partly because God is, in a sense, kind of abstract. He's remote. He's not physically present. And therefore, it's easy to fall in love with something that is not really God and treat it as if it's God, an idea right. of God.
And all of that is interior.
Like, right.
All of that is you're either going to temple, or in this case, we're going to church in our case, doing the rituals, but it doesn't really cost anything. It's not.
You can go through the rituals and not actually have given God your heart,
right.
Your whole heart. Like, how do you know when you love God with all your heart and with all your soul? What's the exterior test, or in the interior test even? Like, what's the proof that you're doing that?
Right. And what Jesus is saying, and what this line from the scripture is saying, from the Old Testament is saying, You can't love God and ignore your neighbor. Like, you can't just, like, I hate my neighbors, I hate other people, but I love God. I'm gonna hate everyone else and love God. It doesn't work that way. And it's also saying that the concerns of this world, the needs of your neighbor, are part of our journey to the next world, part of our journey to God. Like, it's not simply just easy, like, click, and I'm, you know, I love God, therefore I'm going to heaven. Taking care of this, of the concerns of this world, of the needs of our neighbor, of loving our neighbor, those things are part of that as well. So I really like that. Now, Father Willie Raymond was the celebrant today, and he started with this funny story of this pastor. It sounded like a Protestant pastor, and it's you know, apocryphal story, a joke story, where he announced that next week he would give a sermon on the person he would most like to see in hell. And of course, everybody in town wanted to hear that. Not just everyone in congregation showed up.
Actually, I think it was on the signboard outside the church.
Right. But it was going to be who I will announce who I would most like to see in hell. And everyone shows up and everyone's speculating, who is this person that he thinks deserves to be in hell so much? Blah, blah, blah. And he says, you know, when he gets up there, like, you're all here to hear who I would most like to see in hell. Well, I'll tell you who it is. And he announces the name of the saintly Sunday school teacher. And everyone's shocked and amazed. Like, how could you think that of such a person? And the way it's like, I'm trying to remember exactly how he put it, because I'm not sure if this was effective or not, but he basically was saying, because she is so good, she would never be satisfied to stay in heaven in her eternal reward, but would want to carry a cup of cold water to the suffering.
He said, in 2 or 3 weeks, all of hell would be converted and empty.
Right.
That was the punchline.
Right.
If so-and-so was in hell in a couple of weeks, she'd have them all converted.
Yes. I'm not sure that's theologically, it's a problematic story. But his point is, it's not enough to simply just to love God. She would not just love God, but she would love her neighbors, even the damned, so much that she would want them saved. So he told that. And then he kind of went in a different direction and talked about the Dobbs decision and the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And in the context of that, he read this letter from a father to his unborn son who was aborted, which was a letter full of, like, regret and acknowledgement of his love for his son and his regret for what happened and for his role in it. And so it was interesting. It was a little long, I felt.
It was really long.
Yeah. But I mean, it wasn't inappropriate, but I mean, I don't know what you thought of it, but.
Yeah, I was kind of on the fence. Like, I'm not sure how that letter would have been taken by somebody who
was themselves pro-choice,
or I really felt like it might hit very hard with somebody who had themselves had an abortion.
Which is why I think at the end of Mass, like, I think he realized that after the homily, because at the end of Mass, he got up to talk about Rachel's Vineyard and post-abortion counseling available that every diocese has.
I personally know some people who have had abortions and are traumatized by them and regret them.
Yeah.
And I know that some of them would have had to leave during that homily. And so as I was listening, a part of my brain was very concerned with thinking about, how is this going to hit somebody who is on the fence or who is personally grieving or hurt? Like, it felt like it's a very personal, and I feel like the intention was good, and maybe it did some good for some people too, but I think there's always a sort of a two-edged sword with something like that, where it could really open up some trauma for people, and that kind of...
It's a tough line to walk and to do it well. So it wasn't bad.
No, it wasn't bad. It was a good letter. It was heartfelt. And And certainly it's not something that we should, like, it's not an issue that we as a church can ignore. And I did like the fact that he sort of pointed out that this is not should not be a triumphal moment. Like, yay, we won. It's more, we really should be focusing on reaching out and helping people who are in need.
Right.
This is our mission as church, is to be the good Samaritan, right? To be the good Samaritan, to find our neighbors who are suffering and to heal their wounds. I really liked one of the things that he said when he was talking about the gospel was that, you know, we can read the parable as Jesus is the good Samaritan, and he brings the man to the inn or the hostel, however it is.
Yeah, the inn, yeah.
And he says, that's the church. Jesus is the one who comes and finds us, you know, wounded and suffering, and brings us into the church, because the church is where we are meant to be healed. And I did really like that imagery of church is the place where we come when we are wounded to be healed. And I felt like that's sort of the call for us as church right now in the wake of this decision, is to find the people who are wounded, including those people who are pro-choice and who are angry and upset and hurting. And they are not our enemies. They are the wounded people who we need to find a way to reach, to love.
Right.
All the people who are ranting and raving and upset, those wounds, those are symptoms of wounds, of wounded hearts. And what Jesus wants us to do, what he himself is trying to do, is to heal those hearts. Those are people, those are beloved children of God, and that's our job, to be the good Samaritans, to love our neighbors. And our neighbors are all people who need God's love.
Mm. Well said.
So, yeah.
Well, one last thought I had about this was the good Samaritan must have been known to the innkeeper, because, you know, the innkeeper apparently trusts him to pay any extra.
I'll come back and I'll pay you. Like, if it was a stranger, the innkeeper would be like, yeah, sure. You're going to come back and pay me.
I get the sense that this is something he does regularly. Like, he doesn't say that in the text, but it's kind of implicit in a way.
He picks up people and takes care of them and brings them.
Like, the innkeeper's like, oh, he's got another one. I get the feeling. Anyway, yeah.
That's an interesting speculation. Oh, we were going to mention that we really, really loved when we watched
the first episode of the second season of The Chosen, I think it is.
The way they dealt with the parable of the Good Samaritan there.
There's an interesting twist.
Oh, I really, really loved the way Jesus tells that parable in the show. And if you haven't watched The Chosen, it's worth it. Go watch it. I held out for a long time because I'm really leery of
things that everyone loves. Jesus,
especially things that everyone loves.
Right. Yes. This is like this, like when everyone's raving about how wonderful this Christian movie TV series that everyone has to see is. I'm obstinate and I start to dig in my heels.
Yep.
But it's actually, it's well worth watching. To definitely watch.
Especially if you are the kind of person who is allergic to sappy, sentimental Christian stuff.
This is not that.
This isn't that.
Yeah.
So the fact that you're allergic to it should not, don't hold back.
I think it may be the best portrayal of Jesus in a.
Yes.
In a.
I recently, somebody online shared a clip from the really, really not recommended Last Temptation of Christ with Willem Dafoe, is like possibly the worst portrayal of Jesus ever on screen.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely not the right casting for Jesus. Is it
Willem Dafoe? Really?
Yes. He is absolutely the worst on screen Jesus I've ever seen. And I like Willem Dafoe, but not in that role.
No.
But the guy who plays Jesus in The Chosen, whose name I am suddenly blanking on, is really so good.
He comes across as I'm just looking for his name. I don't know, real,
genuine,
genuine, like more real. Jonathan Rumi, more real than any other portrayal of Jesus. He's not ethereal. He's not removed. He's not like the Max von Sydow. Is it Max von Sydow? Jesus and what is it? The one I've watched as a kid.
I didn't watch that one.
Yeah. It's the one everybody my age saw because we all had to watch it in CCD. Now the name's. Anyway, a lot of those ones, they were all so ethereal and removed and, you know, I don't know, this Jesus is very real and like a person you'd know who lived in your town, and which is going to make when they eventually get to the Passion all the more wrenching. I'm kind of not looking forward to that because it's going to suck.
Yeah, I'm not always on board with their portrayal of all of
the
apostles.
Yeah.
But the Jesus is I felt like he really.
Right. And there's a bit of anachronistic stuff, and kind of, we've talked about it before. Yeah. The anachronistic stuff,
if you're at all into historical costumes, you just kind of have to.
Oh yeah.
Just pretend like the costumes aren't really there because.
And at times, a lot of the characters are basically 21st century people delivering biblical lines.
Right. In a way, I feel like this series, The Chosen, feels to me kind of like a medieval. Passion, a medieval mystery play.
Mystery play, okay.
Because the point of the medieval mystery plays was not to try to tell you about life at the time of Jesus. It was to pull you into the story and make it a story about people just like you. Well, in fact, they were put on by the guilds, the Carpenter's Guild or the Baker's Guild. And it was to bring the gospel to life so that you could enter into it and make it was a living thing. And I feel like this is what this series is really trying to do, is not to teach you about some historical past ancient Jesus. It's about what does Jesus have to say to us here now in the 21st century. And on that level, I think that really, really works. Without yet making him just a modern guy wearing robes.
Right.
Although some of the supporting characters kind of feel like modern people wearing robes, I don't feel like Jesus feels like that.
I'm still trying to figure out which one. So Max von Sydow was in the movie The Greatest Story Ever Told, but that's not the one I was thinking of. I remember that. But there was another one. Zeffirelli. Franco Zeffirelli's...
Jesus of Nazareth.
Jesus of Nazareth. I guess that's what it is. Yes. You'd think I would be able to remember that. Getting old stinks. Anyway, let's move on. It's time to go to bed. Before we finish, I'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Anabong A, Ryan O, Justin H, Adika L, and Tom V. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. You can find links from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Send us your feedback at the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com, or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Follow Raising the Bets in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the StarQuest YouTube channel, where you should also make sure to hit the bell to get notifications. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
Not Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest. Here's another podcast on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/secrets.